welcome to the Grant Street Experience. I'm your host, Grant Urban, Chief Resilience Officer here for the City of Pittsburgh. And with me today, I have some exciting guests to talk a little bit about resilience in the City of Pittsburgh and the 1PGH process that we undertook a couple years ago. First of all, I'd just like to introduce folks. Got Rebecca Kiernan with me. Rebecca, hello.
Hey, good morning.
And our guest, Jordan Fishbach from the RAND Corporation. Jordan, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
Awesome. It's great to see you. Jordan, maybe just to kind of jump in real quick, if you could give listeners kind of a little bit of a background on kind of your role at RAND and what brought you to Pittsburgh.
Sure. Yes, happy to do so. So I'm a senior policy researcher at RAND, and I actually just celebrated my 10th anniversary, my 10th RAND-iversary, we call it sometimes.
RAND-iversary.
Yes, I know, that's fun. So I'm a senior policy researcher at RAND, and I also co-direct RAND's Climate Resilience Center. So really, over the course of my career at RAND, I focused on a number of different topics that are loosely related to the world of climate resilience. My background and training, I have a PhD in policy analysis, so really focused on exactly these topics. It's kind of a combination of economics, statistics, a little bit of political science, and a lot of, for me, quantitative modeling as well. With that background, I came into RAND really wanting to focus on issues related to resilience. And a lot of my background is actually on the infrastructure side, on the asset side. And what I'd say is over the course of time, I've worked on a number of projects related to resilience, disaster resilience, thinking more broadly about future planning. More and more I've come to understand that role, you know, it's not just about the stuff and the assets, it's about the people as well. So I now see the world of resilience that we work within and what I do being much more about the intersection between the places that we inhabit, the infrastructure we rely on, and the actual people that benefit from those. More broadly speaking, I'd say that. So I've done work on climate and disaster resilience really across the country. I've done a lot of work in coastal Louisiana, focusing on flood risk assessment and coastal master planning for Louisiana, really starting after the 2005 hurricane season and Hurricane Katrina. We've also looked at post-disaster situations, so did a large assessment of damage and needs in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, and have done sort of post-disaster work in other parts of the country, and have also helped to develop long-range plans and plans that take into account climate change in water scarce areas like the Colorado River Basin, as well as increasingly in areas like Pittsburgh, starting to think about climate resilience here. So we moved to Pittsburgh in 2011, so pretty soon after I started as a RAND researcher, and are very happy residents of the city of Pittsburgh. And actually the way I came to know you both was really starting to get more interested in what does climate resilience look like for a city like Pittsburgh. So much of our work previously had been focused in coastal cities and sort of large coastal cities as kind of a major point of focus and largely around issues of sea level rise. But increasingly, I got curious and wanted to pay more attention to what climate impacts would be in a landlocked city like Pittsburgh in cities that were maybe not that first layer of focus, but nevertheless, we're going to deal with climate impacts ranging from, you know, extreme heat to extreme rainfall. So that's really been the large focus of my work for the last 5 to 6 years.
Great. You know, it's interesting. I'm just looking at you guys side by side on the screen here and realize that we all kind of came to know each other around the same point in time. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, maybe for listeners, if you could frame out kind of the Rockefeller 100 Resilient Cities process in terms of like the platform partnership and the different aspects of the program. And then, you know, Jordan, if we can get into a little bit about what that meant as being kind of our planning partner. But Rebecca, maybe if you start off there.
Sure. So when the city came into the 100 Resilient Cities, when the city of Pittsburgh came into the 100 Resilient Cities program in 2015, which is when I started at the city. Also, I moved here in 2011 as well, Jordan. It must have been a good year.
A good year to move to Pittsburgh.
But when we so when we entered into the 100 Resilient Cities program back in 2015, the Rockefeller Foundation offered Pittsburgh and all of the 100 cities that they funded like four core offerings. So one of them was staffing capacity. So that was my position. Grant was also funded through that. Another was a policy partner. So that was the RAND Corporation, which is how we got Jordan and Linnea to help us with our strategy. Another was access to, you know, the core group of 100 cities, or so 99 other cities. And then the fourth was this idea of platform partners. So the platform partners, which we've talked about before, but that was a platform offering of different large organizations, corporations. There were some government entities on there. Anybody that had a tool or some sort of a resource to offer cities to dive a little bit deeper into, you know, a specific topic. But we worked with RAND, you know, obviously RAND was our policy partner, so they helped us to develop all of our strategies.
You know, just to pick up on that, Jordan, so can you explain a little bit for folks like what that meant, you know, from the RAND side of the equation? You guys were indispensable for the work that Rebecca and I helped lead, but, you know, what does that mean to be a planning partner in terms of kind of, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about, some really seminal work, I think it was the preliminary resilience assessment. But maybe if you can share a little bit about that.
Sure. And I mean, maybe I should take a step back for a moment and I introduce myself as a RAND researcher, but I didn't introduce RAND. So for those who are watching who are not familiar, RAND is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization. So our job and our mission is really to do just this, which is to bring data and analysis to improve decision making and really help in these situations where policies you know, can be improved by research and analysis, and decision makers are looking for science to support those decisions. So this is a great example of that, and one where, you know, RAND, historically we've done a lot of work with federal agencies or kind of on larger efforts, sort of at the national scale. That's not always true, but it's often true. And I think the work that we did with you, with the city of Pittsburgh, is a really good example of how we are trying, and we think it's very important to bring that kind of research and analysis into the local planning context. So as a strategy partner, we had to do a little bit of jack of all trades, and there was some adaptivity involved there. But some of the main things that we did, we helped to have a sort of a kickoff with a main convening and bring together a huge number of the stakeholders that were going to be involved in the resilience planning process. We did some background research. So you mentioned, Grant, the preliminary resilience assessment, which was this look at what are the resilience factors, the shocks and stresses primarily, that affect Pittsburgh and really that we're facing when we think about moving forward and trying to create a more resilient city. So a fair amount of background research, but also a whole lot of convening that went along with that as well. So we pulled together some existing information, but then we also just asked a lot of questions through larger convenings and workshops, as well as through some focus group-like activities to ask residents of the city and other key folks in the region, well, what do you think are the most important factors? What do you see as our long-term stressors and potential shocks that we might face in the future? So a lot of that was really pulling together what opinions of both residents and decision makers around the city were, and then collating that into something that could be useful to help prioritize what resilience investments should look like. So that was the preliminary resilience assessment. And then I think, you know, from there forward, a lot of it was trying to organize and help to structure out what a resilience strategy would look like, recognizing all the work that was happening in Pittsburgh and across the metropolitan region already. So this was not trying to sort of create something out of whole cloth and just start something new, but rather trying to say, how can we build a framework for resilience that can draw from the good work that's already happening around the city, and also acknowledge where there are key gaps that investments or new programs or policies would be needed to fill.
For you, particularly in like the PRA and the strategy building process, I mean, what were some of the lessons and takeaways that you gathered from that, both in terms of like the practice of you know, developing kind of the resilience assessment and the strategy, but also like the content?
Okay. So yeah. So from a practice perspective, I think it was a great experience overall. And in part because a lot of the policy research I do, we sometimes call it sort of participatory analysis or deliberation with analysis. But one of my goals is really to bring our research as much as possible into and put it directly in the hands of folks who are making decisions, but also to get feedback from key stakeholders and understand, well, what are you worried about? What are you thinking about in the future? And how can that help to inform the questions that we're asking and the analysis that we do? And so this process was a tailor-made, a perfect example of that kind of thing, where we were primarily there to listen. And to hear from those participants about what they were concerned about and what they saw as the core issues facing the city building up to this resilience challenge. So as a process, I thought that was great. I like doing that listening. And I think from a content perspective, and I think we see this especially now, those assessments were really accurate. What we learned during the preliminary resilience assessment, I think reflected the challenges that our city faces. And when I think about it in the context of this COVID-19 pandemic that we are now within, I think a number of those long-term stressors that pop to the surface as our key challenges are the key challenges. Those are the ones that are really affecting our ability to respond right now and will affect our ability to recover in the longer term. And I appreciate the fact that we actually, I think you mentioned this one of these conversations a few weeks ago, but we did note that a disease outbreak and pandemic was a possibility. It did not rise to the surface as one of the key shocks that participants were worried about, but it was on the list. And I'm also glad that was something that folks at least were thinking about and we were aware of it through that process. So when I reflect on the overall experience of it, I'm very impressed with how well we were able to capture, and through those voices, we're able to capture the core challenges that we really do face now. And I think I've sort of paused to reflect and think about those conversations in light of what we're currently experiencing, just to recognize the significance of that and how those have in some ways, you know, extended or expanded over time as we face this new shock.
Yeah. You know, Rebecca, Jordan reminds me about this. I mean, going back to the deliberative forums that we organized, I mean, maybe just start with you on this one, like the amount of work that went into setting those up in terms of like, you know, cultivating people and voices was a pretty intense process. But thinking about that then and today, what are some of the things that we could do to, you know, start to re-engage in those deliberative forums in a virtual world? One of the things that was so powerful about, for me, I think about the deliberative forum process is that you could have somebody polar opposites in terms of political spectrum, right? Or ideology, and they have to sit next to one another, and they have to be able to have a civil conversation and come to some sense of agreement. I don't know, Rebecca, maybe just in terms of thinking about that then, and then in the world that we live in now, what are some of your thoughts there?
Well, I think so the way the deliberative forum process works, maybe for those who don't know, is people come, so you have this setup where you have maybe 10 different tables spread out throughout the room, and then you have a formatted agenda of what you go through. So when you come in, you get assigned a seat so that you're not even sitting with your friends. So you're split up, so you don't know anybody. And you're set at one of those tables. And then when the program does start, You know, everybody is given the same sheet of paper with the same notes on it. You see a presentation, so everybody gets the same level set and the same information from the beginning. And then it's, you know, focused on that topic. So everyone learns the same thing up front. Then there's some facilitated questioning that happens at the tables where everybody deliberates. The tables come up with questions that they want to ask of a resource panel. So, you know, everybody hears all the same information and then talks about it together. And then based on that whole program, then we give them an exit survey. And from that exit survey, then we're able to glean all the information that we wanted to get. But, you know, residents get the same, they get information too out of it. So I think what's really good about that format that's not happening right now, just generally in the world, is that everybody gets the same information and then makes their determination based on that information. What's happening right now is, you know, you could watch one, you know, liberal news station, or you could watch, you know, a conservative news station, and you're getting two different sides of a story. But at a deliberative forum, you know, not only are you sitting and talking to people and deliberating, but you're getting that same information. And I think that's what's super important. So, you know, at ours, it was really good for, you know, we gave people the information about some of the, you know, climate risks that we're seeing, you know, what's going on in the city. We gave them some factoids, and then we asked them to help us develop that shocks and stresses profile. And you know, people were able to talk it out and talk about what was happening in their own neighborhoods. And then, you know, we could scale that based on what people are personally experiencing, to, you know, a citywide profile, which I thought was really good.
How do you take that information, and put it, use the word decision support, which is, as a policy guy, one of my favorite kind of phrases. Mm-hmm. How do you take that information from residents and put it into a cogent decision support tool?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing I wanted to build on from what Rebecca was saying too is just this idea of starting from a common basis of fact. And I think that's something that we in the past maybe had taken for granted, or was something that we just sort of assumed would be, when we think about policy analysis, would be something that we could do. That is increasingly a challenged assumption. I have colleagues at RAND who are working on this whole effort around truth decay that really looks at how that common basis of fact has declined over time and compared it to some historical periods, but just recognize the challenges of trying to make decisions and build consensus when you don't have that shared basis. And so I appreciate Rebecca sort of reinforcing that through this deliberative process. As something that you need, and something that's very important to help at least start those conversations. So what I would say is decision support looks very different in different contexts. I do a lot of work again with computer models and think about the ways in which we can use simulation and computer simulation to look at, you know, different scenarios of the future and help bring that back to those who are participating in the conversations. And one of the goals there is actually really to be able to make sure that their perspective is represented in the world that we're looking at. And so it's interesting, I do a lot of scenario analysis. One of the things we try to do is look as widely as possible across what different people think about what the future could bring, to make sure that when we're looking at a particular decision or a strategy that we might develop, that we can account for that as one, you know, set of future possibilities, and that participant feels like their perspective is represented in the work. So that's the quantitative world. For something like this, it's really just mostly about listening, trying to capture those perspectives and distill them down, often using sort of a common framework. Increasingly, and this is not my area of expertise, but a lot of colleagues are using tools to help support that by, you know, text analysis and actually going back and listening to recordings, using computation basically as a way of distilling out some themes that we might otherwise miss when we're just doing this as researchers. So it's often supported by that type of analysis. But ultimately, the goal is to identify where, you know, where are areas of consensus, where do we see particular particular themes emerging from those various conversations. And then building a framework around that and bringing that back both to those participants and to decision makers like you.
I mean, it is kind of interesting. Now, you mentioned a couple minutes ago about, in some regards, how good the process allowed us to be to predict the future. In that, you know, a lot of the content in the preliminary resilience assessment, both from looking at data, but also in talking with people around town here, became a really good prognostication of what was to happen, right? You know, whether that's storm events or weather events or a pandemic, like these are things that are on people's minds. And like Rebecca, to your point, when you level set, you're able to come together with this common kind of predictive analytic tool almost.
I'll challenge you there in one point, which is I almost never use the word predict in terms of predicting the future. In my world, predictions are dangerous and all predictions are wrong. Many people were concerned about the possibility of a pandemic. Nobody predicted this pandemic at this particular time because it was a roll of the dice in terms of how that happened. I often talk about sort of projecting what ifs, right? Like looking at what if cases. This is certainly one that we considered among those what ifs. But I think what we got right was understanding those underlying stressors that were going to matter a lot when we face this kind of a shock. So even if you can't predict the shock, which we can't, or precisely predict the shock, you can say these are the things that are going to really matter and prevent us from bouncing back or bouncing forward after that shock occurs. And I think what was right was recognizing that racial and economic inequity and that the fragmentation that exists across our region were going to be major impediments to response and recovery during that type of shock. And that is exactly what we're seeing right now. And I think we really experienced that. And I want to hear more from you about your thoughts on that. But I go back to that and say, yes, we were right. And that was the right message. And in fact, it sort of reinforces that working on those key stressors is all the more important as we proceed through this shock. And then as we move forward, hopefully into a recovery phase at some point.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you just mentioned kind of one of the key stressors, which is, you know, the racial inequality issue. And one of the, you know, kind of the outcomes or kind of the next steps from the One PGH strategy was the equality indicators work. Rebecca, maybe could you frame that for listeners a little bit? In terms of the work that you and Rick Williams and Linnea and Linnea Warren May from Rand, Jordan's colleague, and Jordan helped to lead. But talk a little bit about the partnership first, and then maybe we can get into some of the technical kind of implications that we've seen or some of the data outputs from that.
Yeah, so the Equity Indicators Report was a two-year study that was also funded through the 100 Resilient Cities program. So we followed a model developed by CUNY, the City University of New York, has an Institute for State and Local Governance. And they allowed cities to apply through this program to be part of this first cohort that would replicate their study. So Pittsburgh, Oakland, Tulsa, Houston,
Dallas,
and St. Louis. So five cities, not Houston. Thanks. That was the first cohort. And basically what we did was we replicated this CUNY model, which in Pittsburgh, we looked at 80 indicators. We took those indicators. So these are data points. This is things like public health outcomes, or asthma rate was one of them, low birth weight, affordable housing, transportation indicators. So we had a series of different topics. So out of the 80 indicators, we then took the indicators and split them up based on demographics, race, gender, economics, so household income, and then based on the outcomes for that particular indicator, we took the highest and the lowest. So for example, in some cases, they were mostly done on race lines, so black versus white population. But some of the outcomes ended up being split more for gender, so male versus female outcomes. Some of them were along economic lines, so high income versus low income. So for example, the asthma rate, because I've looked at this one the most, was double that. So it was childhood asthma hospitalization rate was double for black children than it was for white children. So we were able to start to get to those data points so you could understand the disparities in, you know, health or transportation or whatever outcomes. So we have 80 different indicators, a report over 2 years. So we were able to start to track, changes. So, you know, eventually we would like to, you know, get to a point where you could pinpoint the policy or the program and see maybe how those outcomes might change. Although there's a lot of variables to that.
Great. Yeah. Jordan, thoughts on the equality indicators work there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Rebecca laid it out well in terms of the overall effort. The story that it tells is one that really reinforces the narrative that we've experienced here in Pittsburgh, which is just the profound difference in experience for Black and white Pittsburghers across our region. And I think there's been other research done that comes to similar conclusions, and just the stark inequities that we see across so many of the dimensions that were collected there. Is quite apparent. So there's sort of the big picture story, which I think we understand now, and we see that, and we also see the way in which that as a stressor is definitely contributing to the outcomes from COVID-19 right now, both on the health side, but then longer term in terms of education, in terms of the economy and jobs, what that's going to mean, and recognizing the additional burden placed on Black residents here because of what existed before and the way that they're being disproportionately affected now by this pandemic. So that kind of jumps out at me. But it's also, I mean, Rebecca mentioned, you know, using this to try to pinpoint policies or investments that need to be made. I would also note that, you know, like stepping back and looking across them, it tells a story of the degree of systems change that's needed and the number of things that we need to work on and fix at once. It can feel somewhat overwhelming, I think, sometimes, but recognizing that even if we make progress on one or two of these variables that, you know, that Rebecca described, that in order to really change that picture, it's going to take a significant degree of change across many different, you know, outcomes at once, an investment that spans a whole set of interlocking systems. And increasingly, I think that's what others are pointing to as well, as that sort of transformational change as opposed to incremental change that we're going to need to turn to in the wake of COVID recovery.
Yeah. We touched a little bit earlier on this around the role of fragmentation as being like a key stressor, which is, you know, been an accelerant in some regards, or an amplifier might be a better word in terms of the challenge here with the COVID pandemic. RAND in Pittsburgh had some of its roots with that issue of fragmentation. Any thoughts in that regard, because it's something that has been with us, right? Fragmentation. And it was typically kind of looked at as a government thing. We have a lot of governments, right? Local governments, authorities, small municipalities, but it's a lot more than that, isn't it? The issue of fragmentation. Maybe if you can dive a little bit into it, because I think that also starts to, not just in the public health and racial disparity side, but also in the role of water, kind of another kind of space that you're involved in. I mean, what does that fragmentation, like just saying it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing, but what does it mean, like in terms of when the rubber hits the road, right?
Sure. So I think first it's worth just reviewing the stats a little bit. So there's 90 neighborhoods in Pittsburgh. There's 130 independent municipalities just within Allegheny County. I think the count is about 900 government units across the metropolitan region for Pittsburgh as a whole, which I think is second in the country behind the Chicago metropolitan area in terms of number of government units per capita, you know, per population. And then as Rebecca's noted previously, there's, you know, 3,100 nonprofits in Pittsburgh. So we see this in many different ways. I think the government side is very important to note, but it extends well beyond government. And what it means in practice is that both the resources are so spread out across and differentially spread out across both the public, private, and nonprofit side. In terms of who has those resources, and I think that relates to who has the power to actually enact change as well. And so you see that spread out. It's sort of the resources and power. It's capacity and the ability to actually look at different potential outcomes and make progress towards the goals that you set. But you know, one thing I've increasingly been thinking about, especially in light of this pandemic, is also the number of veto points that fragmentation introduces. When you have that many different decision makers and it's not transparent necessarily where decisions get made, there is such a push towards sort of the status quo. And you know, if you're trying to marshal support for a more significant investment or change, all it takes is one of those decision makers to decide, nope, we're not gonna do that. And to really be able to prevent that from happening in that sort of veto point. And I think one thing I'm much more aware of now is the way in which that dynamic can help to prevent progress towards more transformational change and reinforce the status quo in terms of relationships and those structures. So I think even than we were thinking about then, when we start thinking about recovery from this shock, if there are new resources that come into play for recovery, how will those resources get spent? Who's going to get to make those decisions? And which, you know, organizations, whether it's government or not, will have the capacity to know where to get the resources and what they can do with them? And again, this kind of reinforces that idea that left to its own devices, recovery from a disaster is going to reinforce the status quo and the rich get richer. In terms of being able to effectively use those resources and marshal them towards the outcomes that you want. I think it also, the other thing that strikes me, and I'll build on this a little bit, is just the way that it prevents transparency. The way that for residents of the city and the region, where it can be so hard to know, well, why is this the way it is? And, you know, a silly example of this is, I don't know how many Pittsburghers know just how many roads in Pittsburgh are not owned by the city of Pittsburgh and not operated by the city of Pittsburgh, but in fact are owned by the state Department of Transportation. And so if you want to do anything with those roads, then you have to work with PennDOT, with the Department of Transportation to make progress. And so even the most basic decisions or the most basic city functions that most people would say, okay, well, the mayor can do that. In fact, get much more complicated because you have all of these different actors involved in what seems like a fairly innocuous and simple decision. You had mentioned the water space. So I'll note that, you know, I do a lot of work on water infrastructure and water resources. And it's particularly apparent there, where we have a regional wastewater system, the Allegheny County Sanitary Authority, that manages wastewater from about 83 municipalities across the region. And they have responsibility for taking in and treating wastewater and dealing with our region's perpetual issues with this old combined sewer system. So they are sort of the last line of defense in terms of managing that system. However, most of our stormwater and our wastewater system is actually owned and operated by the municipality, not by that regional authority. And so when it comes to repairing pipes and actually taking care of most of that, it falls on those 83 individual municipalities, including Pittsburgh. And they have wildly different capacity to do things with that. And so you've got this situation set up where it might make sense and there might be, you know, economies of scale to invest more systematically to reduce pipe leakage, to try to put in more significant investments to reduce sewer overflows. and to manage the system more as a system. And yet what we really have is a whole patchwork of different little pieces of that that are all connected together and that don't work well because of the differences in capacity and resources between those municipalities and the need for coordination. So that, I mean, it's a small example, but we see it in other places as well when you think about sort of municipal boundaries and government boundaries versus watershed. Because as it turns out, water doesn't care where your city boundary is, you know, border is. Flooding doesn't, you know, flood issues don't emerge just in one place and not another. It's going to flow where it's going to flow. And we, you know, we did not draw boundaries here thinking about watersheds, long ago. And so what that means is it puts a further onus on everyone involved. If you're going to look at sort of watershed scale planning, if you're going to deal with issues like flooding, that's going to inherently put a burden on all of the government and non-government actors there to pull together, see it as a watershed and focus, some people call it sort of a one water approach, start to bring those perspectives together to make progress on goals collectively. And it's going to involve a dozen different actors instead of one or two.
You said the one water, you made me think about like the Dutch water boards, right? You know, effectively they've been around for 400, 500, 600 years in some cases, you know, originally created to manage kind of the seawater, right? And building a system of dikes, but basically have evolved to managing the full cycle of water.
That's right. I think that's a great example of exactly the opposite, right? So those are these water districts and these water boards that are organized around watersheds. And they have the authority and the resources to think systematically about water quality, about water supply, about flood management. And as it turns out, it's a lot easier and more effective to work that way than the system that we have.
Yeah, it's just an integrated approach, right? Like that's the thing that's so simple and elegant about how it's constructed, but also very effective. We started to kind of get into this a little bit, but you know, climate was another major kind of risk that folks identified as part of the 1PGH process. And you know, Rebecca, we've started to do some work now around the issue of climate adaptation, which is kind of a conversation just 4 or 5 years ago. We built a mitigation strategy, which we're working through kind of the implementation of, but just in the last couple of years, we've seen the need to shift, and not just shift, but align that mitigation conversation with an adaptation conversation. Rebecca, maybe some of the figures that you've started to see in the work that you and our colleague Melanie Areola have started to develop in terms of rain and those impacts. And then Jordan, where do we need to go given kind of these changes, right? Rebecca, maybe if you want to start there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the figures that we were looking at is actually Jordan's figure. So that's the 2018 and you can probably say the numbers better than I can, but all I can think of is that graph that you have of 2018 that's off the graph.
Right. Sorry. Go ahead, Rebecca. I'll jump in after you.
And that much rain, not just flooding, but it has a lot of other implications. So, we're starting to see more landslides. So when we do have a deluge of rain it's rain and, I guess not right now, we're kind of in the middle of a seems like a desert spell. When we do have so it's an increase in precipitation generally, events themselves, but also in intensity and duration. So when we do see those really intense microburst type of storms, they're taking our hillsides, which are already a little bit unstable because we haven't been maintaining them properly. A lot of them are overgrown, but that water just kind of comes in and washes away all the soil. In 2018, we had record rain, but we also had record landslides. What the adaptation strategy is starting to look at is, what are those big climate vulnerabilities that we should be thinking about? How is the weather changing? And then how is it impacting, not just our residents, but also our property? and our own operations at the city. So, you know, Jordan mentions, you know, PennDOT owns some of the roads. Obviously, we have lots of private landowners here, also, you know, public nonprofit landowners, but not under city control. But the city owns a significant amount of property. So, you know, how should we be thinking about changing our own operations and managing our facilities and our, you know, 1,200 acres of greenways and I think another 1,200 acres of parks to be able to handle those changes that we're seeing in temperature, rainfall, you know, landslides, et cetera.
Yeah. No, I think those are all great points. So just to build on what Rebecca was saying, what comes out of efforts like the National Climate Assessment, looking at the Northeast region, for example, projecting forward a general consensus that we are already seeing changes in heavy rainfall, especially. So this increased intensity and duration of rainfall events, and then particular increases for those big events that you were mentioning. And so that's what sort of found for the region. And what we've experienced in recent years is really seeing that within Pittsburgh as well. So you mentioned 2018 was by far the wettest year on record that we had, and we had a number of very big storms that happened two summers ago in 2018. 2019 was, I think, the third or fourth wettest year on record as well. So we had a very wet year last year that also included a number of big storms. However, the irony of climate change is that it can both be too wet and not wet enough, altogether kind of within one place, that we are seeing, you know, what we see are impacts at the extremes. And so this year, our experience is more one of heat and what a hotter summer looks like in the city of Pittsburgh. So we've had a number of 90-degree days, much more so than the average already, and we're still pretty early in the summer as it goes. And it's also true that we will be impacted by heat effects and thinking about urban heat island effects that would tend to exacerbate or make that worse. So for our city, those climate impacts of excess heat and dealing with heat and dealing with very heavy rainfall are kind of the main concerns that we need to focus on for adapting to climate change. Now, Rebecca, as you mentioned, that implies a whole systems level degree of change that's needed in terms of thinking differently about how we manage our infrastructure and then how we manage the land that the city owns and operates and elsewhere to help offset that. And that means, fairly significant investment to improve on landslides. It means rethinking what our parks and our green space can do and can support. And it means significant investments also in sort of the gray infrastructure, the underground infrastructure that we have not invested enough in over the last decades to century, let's say. So it's kind of all of those things. And it's not going to be cheap. It's going to be expensive. And I think that we know that. But it's very important to note that even with this sort of dollar tag associated with investing in climate adaptation, we also know that that is still a better way to go than to wait for some major climate disaster to happen and try to pick up the pieces afterwards. So in other parts of the country and those that have dealt with significant disasters and hurricanes, it's still the most common approach or the norm in the disaster world is that we do our investment in America after the event occurs. We reinvest and we pour money into an area during a recovery phase. Whereas it would have been a lot less expensive to have made investments pre-disaster and done the mitigation work in advance to help prevent that disaster from happening or make it less severe when that disaster does occur. And that continues to be true. We are lucky in Pittsburgh. We have not had a major climate disaster in a while, but that's not to say that we couldn't. So it suggests that there are a lot of reasons and a lot of good arguments for making those investments, really, really going bigger on systematic change so that we can avoid, a climate disaster and that we can be prepared for the types of changes that are coming down the road with respect to heat and heavy rainfall.
That's an interesting piece too. I mean, we're trying to get ahead of this by developing kind of this adaptation research. But it's such a long learning curve in terms of creating awareness amongst practitioners, let alone kind of engaging residents and, you know, all the system shifts that you're talking about. You know, just like the pandemic, and that being kind of one of our preliminary resilience assessment, you know, items that we identified, what could a major climate event look like here? And one of the reason why I ask that is part of the challenge that we've had in getting traction on the adaptation conversation, I think, has been because we are an inland city. Coastal flooding or a tsunami or a hurricane are kind of the newsworthy events, right? You know from your experience in working with Katrina that you know, both the challenge, but also it's not difficult to shine a light when a Cat 5 hurricane comes through. What are some of those events that Pittsburghers or other inland places might look at as being some of the potential scenarios?
Sure. I'll give two examples. So we have not had a major river flood in Pittsburgh in quite some time, and that is by design. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers operates a series of lock and dam infrastructure going up our rivers to help manage that and help to prevent an uncontrolled river flooding event. So I think I wouldn't say we're complacent, but we just haven't experienced anything like that for many decades, going back to the, you know, the 1930s and the St. Patrick's Day flood. But we're still a river community, and a big enough a rainfall event or a rainfall unfolding over time upstream, you know, that infrastructure is not perfect, and something could fail. And were that to happen, we would see significant flooding in the most developed areas of the city, right along, you know, the rivers and waterways and going into downtown. So I think I point to that and say we have not experienced this for a long time. But it's not to say that there's zero risk or that we shouldn't be worried about that. So that's sort of one, and I think it's one worth noting of, you know, significant rainfall and the potential for river flooding. The other one, and I've been thinking about this too, is a really major heat wave. Heat waves are killers, and they are can be among the most destructive sort of climate disasters that can be experienced. You know, folks often point to the Chicago heat wave decades ago, but that's something that worries me. And again, we are comparatively cooler here than some other parts of the country, at least for now. But a significant heat wave could have that kind of effect. And especially if it's combined with some other disaster, like right now, you know, if we're already experiencing these very hot temperatures and we can't open cooling centers because it's not safe to gather and congregate there. So that kind of combination of different factors, I don't know that folks imagine the pandemic and a heat wave at the same time. But, you know, nevertheless, that combination and the way that those can exacerbate one another, that the tools to respond to a heat wave and the things we might do for vulnerable or elderly folks that don't have access to air conditioning, we don't have those tools right now. So that's really a concern.
Just a couple quick factoids too. Talking about the heat, both of those actually, you know, in this past year, we've experienced both from an infrastructure side. So one of the things that we've been able to do with our facilities is to sign up for what's called the demand response program, which is effectively an electricity curtailment strategy on extreme heat or extreme cold days when the grid gets stressed. Large consumers have the ability to kind of reduce their consumption and then ultimately kind of adjust kind of their pricing and achieve a rebate status, which is kind of the incentive. And we signed up in end of May, early June, and we've already had 5 notifications. And part of the pitch too is like, well, this doesn't happen all this often and you guys will be prepared. But Laura Marion and Chris Hornstein on our team and Sylvia Harris, who's our IT lead, is, you know, we've formed this team and, you know, we quickly had to be able to respond to these events. And it really gets your mind thinking in terms about exactly those things you're saying, the multi-attributional connections. The other one is just in thinking about river flooding and the stress that puts on infrastructure that you see, there's also strain on infrastructure that you don't see. So whenever you hit a 23-foot flood stage, that basically creates a cascade in a lot of the infrastructure in downtown Pittsburgh. So you have to start pumping water basically out of tunnels, otherwise like the heating and cooling and electrical and water infrastructure gets compromised. So there's some real challenges that you could see in those types of scenarios.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point. And one way in which we look a little bit like coastal cities that are dealing with sea level rise and concerns about that. But it's interesting that you mentioned that, because you can also imagine, well, what else would happen under a river flooding condition is that outfalls that allow excess stormwater into the river may not be able to open. And so you then would get the system backing up as well, and more sewer backups into people's basements, which is already a chronic issue that we deal with across the region. So I think that's a really good point, and one that just indicates how much this can cascade and build when you face an event like that.
Jordan, this is some fascinating stuff. We're coming up against time. One of the things that Rebecca and I always like to ask guests, just before we wrap up here, what are some of the things that you're reading, listening to, or watching these days? We just kind of like to go around the horn and see what if there's anything interesting you're consuming and would like to share with folks.
Sure. Well, I will note one which seems very appropriate for this conversation. So in our pandemic Netflix binging, we finally started on Parks and Recreation. So we're in season 2 of Parks and Rec, which is giving me a whole different perspective on what it means to be, to work at a city and to, to be the city agencies. I will say I think about you guys fairly often during episode watching, but we are enjoying that quite a lot. So that's our light. I mean, there's so much heavy right now that is our light watching. And I highly recommend Parks and Rec if you haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I feel like everything else I would mention is much heavier. I wanted to start with the more lighthearted one. Let's see. So I will say that a fair amount of our focus right now. Well, I should say this. My reading in my off hours is almost exclusively like science fiction and fantasy, because I can't read nonfiction books when I'm going to bed. I can't think too much about the things I think about all day when I'm doing that. So I will say that during the pandemic, the amount of reading that I've done on the fantasy world has probably gone up a bit. And one of the really nice things is I'm actually, I'm a big fan of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. And right now I'm in the middle of a read of Lord of the Rings with my 8-year-old. And so that has been one of my major points of focus. He's still a little young for some of the things, but I think he's doing quite well with it. And he's actually very lucky. He's getting me reading Lord of the Rings to him. And then my wife is reading Harry Potter to him in parallel. So he's sort of getting the ultimate experience right now. Yes, at once. And I don't know which one will finish first, but it's been a lot of fun to do that.
That's awesome. That's terrific. Rebecca, how about you?
Not a whole lot. I was really excited that Unsolved Mysteries made a comeback. I don't know if anybody saw that. I was a big Unsolved Mysteries junkie when I was a kid. So. Right. Not the same without Robert Stack, but there's some pretty good new episodes that I watched.
Did they find a new voice to replace Robert Stack?
It's not really a replacement. There's not really like a host anymore. So, they like flash his shadow in the beginning just so he's got that presence, but you can't really replace that voice.
Good. Grant, I'll mention one more because I'll do one serious one. So last night, our boys were able to go to the grandparents' house. We are now podding with the grandparents after a lot of work, and this is the first time we've had a time away from our two kids since March. And so, what did my wife and I do? We watched the CNN special, W. Kamau Bell's United Shades of America. And which is, if you haven't seen it, is all about Pittsburgh, and a lot of folks that we know here. So that was our light fun, date watch, was United Shades of America.
That's terrific. That's terrific.
What about awesome. You, Greg?
Me? So I will say that, my 12-year-old and I, we just, binge watch and finish Parks and Rec. Same thing, Jordan. So we took your advice on that. And I'd say it's about 95% true. There's there's maybe like 5% fabrications in there, but yeah, we both finished it, and I will say at the end, you know, you're kind of like all good character driven series, you're a little sad to like see everybody go. So we definitely the eyes welled up with that. And then my summer read as Rebecca knows, I'm a big Anthony Bourdain fan. So for Father's Day, my wife got me Kitchen Confidential. So I'm about halfway through that. You know, now looking for like Tony's kitchen gadget collection, his recommendations. So I'm looking for a good chef's knife right now. So, but it's a terrific, if you like food, if you like travel, it's a pretty great summer read. So that's my, like you, like I read serious stuff all day. So, those are kind of my escapes right now. So terrific. Well, guys, I tell you what, this is always, I knew this would be a great conversation. Jordan, we're going to have you back soon just to get some updates and to dive into, love to get into more about some of the stormwater work that you guys are working on and some of those details there that are forthcoming. I know that our listeners would really enjoy in the coming weeks and months. So we'll be talking to you soon. Rebecca, I'll see you in a little bit on the next Zoom call. Won't be long till we're reconnected again. So, but thank you both. Great conversation. And thank you all out there for listening to the Grant Street Experience. We look forward to catching up with you next time. Thanks so much. Thanks to Bill and Joy and Alex and David on our team, on our production team, for putting this together for everyone. And we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you. Thank you.